Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. This is me, Andy Kirkpatrick. It's Sunday morning, and the baby's still asleep, so I've sneaked upstairs to try and do a podcast. So I hope you appreciate it. Anything been going on? Nothing. Nothing's been going on. Actually, I've got a few questions here. I've been sitting on my computer for a while, so I'm going to answer those. But actually, it's funny. I got back in touch with I did Johnny Dawes. Some of you know Johnny Dawes is like when Johnny Dawes wrote his book. Is it called Touching Myself or something? It's something with myself. I ended up doing like the Kindle version of the book for him, which is like, it's not that difficult, but it's a bit of a pain. It's a bit like trying to do a website like in 2000, like it was like doing like HTML and. Back in the day, it was very difficult. Like the first website I ever did, I was going to Greenland and we needed a website. So I had this guy Ben Saunders, who maybe I've mentioned him before. Like Ben Saunders he probably still is the person I'd always look to of like if you can look at people, and really envy them, and you can either hate them. And, you know, it's like, what's that thing about, it's like swallowing poison and wanting the other person to die. Like when you kind of hate people, you really envy, you know, like a lot of, we live in the world of envy these days. But anyway, I just looked at Ben and, you know, like my instinct was just to hate him because he was all suave and sophisticated. He lived in London. He could wear, it was one of those people where you could just like the way it's like someone out of the what's that film? Not the League of Gentlemen. But he just wore like brogues and, chinos and the shirt. And, you know, like he was a man's man? I don't know. But he was like, so it looked like he'd been to, you know, being in the army or something, and you'd be like hanging out at the Royal Geographical Society and popping into Google and, drinking, gin and tonics on some roof terrace somewhere in London. And I was, I was like stuck in Sheffield. I was like, it's one of those. It skied to the North Pole. That was his kind of claim to fame. Anyway, but I remember it probably was probably like a good moment for me where I'm not supposed to talk about class on this podcast anymore being working class, but by the way the class, you're always the same class, you never get out of it. So you know, you could be, if you're born whatever class you are, You know, you could be born to the aristocracy, and you could end up being a crack addict living on the streets of Manchester, but you're still an aristocrat. And it's the same with if you're working class or middle class or whatever. Anyway, but one of the worst things that trap people in the limiting factors of their class is envy and wanting everyone to be like everybody else, but at the same time not wanting to be a traitor to who you are and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, but I decided instead of just hating this person from a distance, I would just try and work out what he was doing that was effective. And so I started, he had a website. So I didn't have a website. I didn't even really, I didn't really think people had websites, but he had his own website. He was on Twitter. I didn't know what Twitter was. I don't think he was on Facebook, which is a good sign. And, he just did everything. He just did everything really well. He was just good. He just obviously knew a lot of people, or he was probably observing other people like I was. He was probably looking at Steve Jobs or someone. I thought Steve Jobs was some, yellow pages for people who wanted plumbers or something. So I remember I must have been in contact with him. Maybe I don't know if I was, but I basically found out how if on what would it be what I've been using, maybe it was Firefox or something, it wasn't just like in your normal browser, but I found out through on your browser you could actually look at the HTML code on the website. I think I bought like HTML for Dummies, but I never read it, so I could see the code for his website that I thought looked really amazing. And I just looked at it and I was like, I'll just copy all this code and I'll stick it. I worked out what a server was. You could pay some money and you had this folder on some server somewhere, whatever a server was, and you could upload stuff like an image or whatever. And your HTML files and the index.html or HTM was going to be your homepage and blah, 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 blah. So I just worked it out backwards, like going backwards, working how he did it. And so I basically took his website and I just changed all the images. I just changed the image, image destination. And then I changed all the text and I changed like the, bensaunders.com, all that kind of stuff. And I just changed it all to, going to greenland.com or something. And then I just uploaded it all. And there, hey presto, I had like a fully functioning website that didn't look as good as Ben's. It looked shit basically, but it kind of worked and it did the job. But then, this is another good thing to learn, is that it's not long afterwards, Ben Ben emailed me and he said, "Hi, in a nice way, he said, you've basically stolen my website, but no worries. But you've also stolen the tracking code at the bottom, which every time someone goes to your website, it's appearing." On my tracking data, like people are going to this website. So I was like, oh, I do apologize. Not and laughed. Anyway, so I laughed the hell off. It's a bit like the story about meeting Bear Grylls, and how Bear Grylls was really nice and charming and nice to my wife and stuff. And it was like, that's something you need to learn. Like Ben could have just been really angry and pissed off at me, but what good would it do really, so it's much better to kind of be nice to people who are basically ripping you off and shaming you and stuff. So what's that got to do with this? So I was doing I don't know why I offered to do Johnny Dawes's Kindle book, but because as I say, like Kindle now, I think you're on Kindle 3 or EPUB 3 or whatever it is, but it's just a bit of a nightmare, really. Everything just looks crap. It looks okay if it's just text, but it's if you're going to put any images in, it's always kind of, it's just a pain to do. Anyway, but I decided I'd help Johnny Dawes out because I like Johnny Dawes. And anyway, so I did his book. And in those days, if you were selling something on Amazon, they would send you a check. So the checks started coming to my house for his book. So I think I just ripped them up. And then I was like, Johnny, you need to give me your bank details. So he gave me his bank details. And then after a month, I said, have you been getting any money? And he was like, no. Anyway, so I checked and he'd given me the wrong bank details. So somebody was getting paid for it. And then I think I tried. Johnny's one of these people where you end up kind of... You end up just kind of despairing of him. I'm probably exactly the same. You end up kind of despairing of him and just like leaving to his own devices. So anyway, I got back to him this week after literally it was 10 years ago, I think, when I did his Kindle book. So it's like, oh, hi. I know it's taken me a while to get back to you, like 10 years, but did you ever sort this out? And he was like, no. So anyway, I've managed to like sign back into his Kindle account, and he'd sold like 600 books or something. He never got paid for them, so I'm trying to sort that out at the moment. Why am I telling you this story? Johnny Dawes, is that probably the most exciting thing that's happened this week? Is like contacting Johnny Dawes. Yeah. There was a reason for telling you about Johnny Dawes. I was actually trying. Speaking of getting in touch with people, that was just stuff off of my head. That wasn't meant to be a kind of segue to something else. But I actually went back on. I went on old fashioned technology. I went back on to what's it called? LinkedIn. I don't have a Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account, but I do have a. But anyway, I didn't have a LinkedIn account. But as someone I know who I used to work for with Montaigne, went off to work for Hagloffs in Sweden, and then I saw he'd got a good job as a design manager type person at Mammut. So I went on to LinkedIn to try and get in touch with him, because all his email addresses were for old email addresses. So I managed to get in touch with him. But anyway, so I stayed on LinkedIn. I started looking up all the people, just looking up loads of people who are dead to me, and like seeing what people are up to, like in, you know, people I've known in like businessy people and all that kind of stuff. Like a few interesting things. One person. I was looking at someone who I used to work with. I was looking at his like what was going on his LinkedIn page, and he was talking about somebody. I was like, oh my God, that's the most ugliest woman I've ever seen in my life. Oh my God, that's horrendous, you know. And then I started looking at their name, and I said, like, that actually looks familiar. And then I was like looking closer, and I realised it was actually a bloke I used to know who is now a she, her, or it is. And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, so I was like, I just did not see that happening. Anyway, so I emailed someone. I was like, oh my God, like, I can't believe that X person is now a she, her. And then you're like, and he's like, oh, if you think that's weird, so-and-so is now a she-her as well. I was like, what the fuck? Anyway, so I was like, I was looking at the, so that was kind of, I kind of knocked me for six. Like one of the people, it doesn't kind of surprise me. Like I don't want to be controversial. I don't want to get like cancelled like JK Rowling, but, I do completely think all this stuff is this sort of body dysmorphia kind of stuff. I don't believe in the old trans stuff. You know, I definitely some people are born. It's not you're born in the body you're given. Basically, that's a problem. And some people just don't like. I think some people just. I think some people are just on the inside. They're not how they look on the outside. You know, like they're, you know, like someone's got like a big nose or whatever, or they've got a funny shape, their head's too small for their head or something. But you know, inside they don't see themselves like that. They see themselves as somebody completely different. So, So yes, that's what it's like. And so it's taken me a few. You know, I'm still trying to get over it. It's kind of so. I say one person. You know, I don't really. She, her, it, whatever is definitely in my mind. They're definitely not a woman, but they're also definitely not a man. They're just like who they are. Like they were never really. I won't mention any names, but they were always like uniquely themselves, if you know what I mean. You know, they were like amazing, talented, interesting people, but they were just who they were. You know, they were, you could say they were genderless or whatever. It was, so it's kind of, it's, I don't know. I think a lot of reading into it, I think a lot of people go down that route. They don't feel very happy with who they are. So then they try to be somebody else. But they're equally as unhappy as being, you know, Dalvinder or something. And then they probably migrate back to being, you know, just trying to come to terms with who they are. So it's, yeah. Luckily, you die, don't you? Like, you know, if you get a shit hand, you die soon enough. So it doesn't really matter eventually. Yeah. So anyway, but one thing that was kind of weird was going through the being all the old LinkedIn stuff was, I don't know. It's kind of a little bit mad. Like a lot of these people are in the UK, and they're all. It's like they're all being taken over by. They're all kind of like AI people. Like they're all saying exactly the same thing. They're all just on some weird, you know, you know. Like there was somebody who was going on about what's it called, circular economy, or what's the thing, economy, where it's like, you know, is it circular economy? Anyway, it's the economy where it's like, you know, buy, mend, give to somebody, finding a bin, blah, 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 kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, people are obviously on some funding stream that they're getting money from someone to promote this kind of circular economy. And there's people saying, you know, like two thumbs up, love heart, high heel shoe, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's like banging on it. And I'm just one of those people where I'm like, everyone, you know, you got like 1,000 comments saying, go for it. This is the future circular economy. And I'm the idiot who comes up and says like, is this not just like what people do? Like, is this not preparing yourselves for like, you know, like the collapse of the economy? And if you can't buy anything, if you haven't got any money, then it is a circular economy. Like whatever you get, you're going to have to keep it for a long time. You're going to have to mend it. And, you know, like it's like you're basically taking a concept that most people in the world who are living on like a dollar a day, we completely recognize. It's like, that's what you do. And it's like this new idea, it's called the circular, you know, it's like a color, you know, inclusive, circular, anti-racist Christmas for the, you know, chicken dinner. You know, you get the chicken and then you cook it. And then you like you take the bones and you put it in a pot and you make some soup out of that, and then you take what's left and you make some more and you make a stock out of that, and then you get the bones and then you make them into like a child's toy or something, and it's just kind of like, oh, that sounds like an interesting, you know, concept. So is that not just what most people, our grandparents did? So yeah, I think I was saying on the other pot. Previously, my kind of neighbours, like he was like one of 16 children, and they were so poor that the boys wore like the hand me downs from the girls. So the boy is wearing a dress because he had no money to buy him any clothes, and he's out in the wild Irish weather in a dress, you know, like a 4-year-old child. You know, like that's a circular economy, basically, you know, and that dress would probably get made into something else eventually. Like when there was no more girls, you probably, you know, you'd, God knows. I remember once when my wife had a baby, there was a woman, in the hospital in the same bit where all the women are, have had a baby. And she was saying like, she was saying, she's that woman over there. That woman's had like 14 children. And I was like, 14 children? 14 children? Like, how, what kind of car would you have with 14 children? And my wife was like, I don't know, but you could park it in your vagina. Anyway. So, so yeah, so it was kind of weird, but it made me think how all these people are basically going to get wiped out, like in the coming, you know, we've got like a recession coming that's probably worse than any of us have ever experienced before in lots of aspects, but you got to laugh, haven't you? And, but all these people who are living in this kind of fantasy world, they're basically like, good thing about a communist, you know, or a proper socialist is they did actually want to make stuff. They wanted to have factories and women hammering bits of coal and all that kind of stuff. They were actually for about production and making more tractors and you know, they actually, you know, so these people aren't like communists. They basically just want to destroy themselves and destroy everything else. Like, they want to, like, I lived through deindustrialization when I was a kid, like in the UK in the 70s and 80s. Like, I remember what it was like. But these people are basically cheering it on, and it's really mad. I don't know if they think they'll be the last people to lose their jobs, but I expect they'll probably be the first people, because they're actually, most of them have just got bullshit jobs, basically. You know, that's the problem, you know, in a lot of the tech industry. Like, all those people losing their jobs, like thousands and thousands and thousands of people losing their jobs, are not the useful people. You know, they're all the people with the bullshit jobs who are all just going, you know. Like, so yeah, it's kind of weird. I kind of like put it into a few little, you know, like happy slappy, happy clappy conversations people were having, and people were like really, really offended, you know. So it's just pointless getting involved with those kind of people. So I guess it's like trying to, do you know, like when you're really afraid of something, like a ghost or something, when you're a kid, you want to like hide under the cushions. Maybe it's a little bit like that. Maybe the reality is, you know, it's a tough thing to deal with. And I guess if you just, like, a lot of people I know have given up like quite good careers or even their own businesses, and they've gone into working for the universities. Like in Sheffield, nearly everybody I know works for the university, and it's a bit like a Ponzi scheme. Is that the university is getting like bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're taking in more and more, exploiting these poor young people, you know, getting all the money off them for bullshit degrees that aren't really worth anything. And suddenly the whole thing's going to burst, and all these people are going to lose their jobs. It's going to be, I guess it'll go back to how it was, where only like 25% of people go to university. So I don't know. So if you work in the university, I don't know what I'm talking about, but it is, you know, you definitely want to get a job, you know, you want to get a job where, you know, even that it's kind of bullshit proof, you know, like a bin man or something, you know, something like that. So anyway, so I should get on to some of these questions, because baby's going to probably wake up soon. So, well, the first one, I probably won't read it out, but I have quite a lot of questions about drawing pictures. Like, I draw quite a lot of diagrams for my books and stuff. And like, when I was a kid, I was really into drawing. And then I think what I really wanted to do, I really wanted to go in the army. But my mum wanted to go to art college, but she didn't. She had to go and get a job in a bakery instead. So I think she kind of imprinted onto me that I should go to art college. But really, I just wanted to like kill people and stuff, shoot guns and stuff. And so anyway, so I drew all my life until I went to art college. And then I failed to get onto a degree. I did like a foundation course. And I really enjoyed that, but then I didn't get onto a degree, and then I just stopped drawing altogether for years and years and years, until I started writing gear articles and some technique articles for climbing magazines. And so then I started doing some sort of hand drawing, you know, rough drawings that would end up in the magazine. And then I think when I wrote Cycle Vertical, they said, oh, we do you have like an illustrator? You know, we'll have to illustrate some of these mountains and stuff. Do you have an illustrator who you'd like to do this? And I was kind of like, oh, bollocks that. I'm not going to get somebody else to do it. I'll just do it. But I hadn't really done any real drawings for a long, long time. So I just, I think I downloaded Painter, who makes it Corel Painter, on my computer. And I literally banged out all these pictures from a book in like one day and sent them all off. And it ended up in the book. And that was probably the beginning of doing illustrations for the books, for all my books. But they're more like, they're more like pictures of mountains and things. So, but I also needed to be able to do technical drawings of like carabiners and all that kind of stuff. So I end up learning Adobe Illustrator. So Photoshop and a lot of those things, you're just moving like pixels around. So if you drew a line, it's just a load of pixels of a certain color. You can mix them together or whatever, but it's just like a line of pixels of a different diameter. But Adobe Illustrator is a vector drawing thing where it's more kind of, it was more mathematical? There's still like pixels there on the screen, but it's more, you know, like this line goes from X300 to X160 or something, blah, blah, blah. So, but you're just creating points and the lines are going between them, and sometimes they're curved, sometimes they're straight. And that's how you build up like a drawing. So it means with a vector drawing is it could be the size of your computer screen, or it could be the size of the house, and it would look the same. It wouldn't look pixelated. Where if you drew a picture which on Photoshop the size of your computer screen, and then you do it to the size of a billboard, it would look terrible. That's why you often in the past used to get people where they'd have an image in a newspaper or in a magazine that was too small, and it would all be pixelated and look terrible. So that's why that used to happen. So anyway, but it probably took me a good 10 years to learn how to, because again, I didn't go any courses and no one taught me how to do it. I think I just got like a free stroke, you know, like dodgy copy of Adobe Illustrator, and kind of learn by like copying other people, like how did they do that? And I would like, you know, I just try and copy it and slowly learn that way. I always used to tell my son that he should learn Adobe Illustrator, because it's a good skill to have. Like a lot of people can use Photoshop, but Adobe Illustrator is like a little bit harder to use. And he always just ignored me, probably because he was only five. but eventually you end up going to college for like 2 years and doing design, graphic design. So you learn how to use Illustrator. Anyway, so it's a really good skill. So that's how I do most of my, nearly all of my drawings. I still use Painter for some things if it's more like arty-farty. So I use Adobe Illustrator. And the good thing about it is, say you draw like a figure of eight knot, or you draw like a screw-kit carabiner, you can just take that drawing and you can put it into other, you know, integrate into complex, you know, other drawings. So you only have to draw one figure of eight and one carabiner or one person abseiling, and you can just more easily just paste it into other drawings. If you ever look at any of my books, you'll see often it'll be the same DMM carabiner will be on every single thing. So it saves a lot of time. It is still quite a long process. So, and you're always kind of improving. You're always like looking at stuff you've already done, and it just looks crap. And you're trying to improve next time. So it's a Yeah, it's quite a long, drawn out process. I get it, long drawn out process. So yeah, but it's again, it's a good, skill. It's like one of those skills, like in terms of, my climbing life, you learn all your climbing skills. But it's a bit like you get these people who are they're in like Delta Force, or they do it. They're in, you know, they're in some kind of Barmy Army thing where they're really good at killing people. But when they leave, there are kind of limited skill set, and the real world is like, yeah, you know, what can you do? I can kill people. There's that really good bit. There's that good bit, isn't it, in the end of that TV series, The Pacific, very highly recommended TV series, where he says he comes out of the army and he's in somewhere, and they say, what can you do? And he's like, oh, I can fire a, I can fire a 60 millimeter mortar or something. And, you know, anyway, but it's that kind of thing. So a lot of your climbing skills aren't really that transferable into the real world. Maybe if you do like rope access or something like that, it could be they're handy, but often maybe they're a, you know, they're a detriment. You might be better rope access if you're not a climber, if you just get into it from being a scaffolder or somebody. But other skills, you know, by learning other things, like learning how to write to some degree, learning how to stand on a stage and talk, or learning how to do slideshows, or, you know, all these kind of extra sort of bolt-on skills to climbing are really handy later on in life, because you can just make a living doing that thing. I think someone asked me the other day, like, what would you do? Like, you know, something about being a professional climber, and I was like, you're much better learning a trade, as like a trade where you can pick it up and drop it. Like, you want a trade that, this is a trade rather than a degree. Like, a trade is much more useful. So if you have a trade, then if you have the right kind of trade, you can, first of all, you can probably get a job anywhere in the world. You could go and live in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, in some shithole country. You know, you can go anywhere you want with a good trade. And because there's always like a demand for them. And also you make a lot more money than someone who has a degree. Like, yeah, you might, if you're working, you know, in some, you might be making a lot of, you know, but basically you leave school and you're told, and when you're at school, basically the pinnacle of your education is to end up being a professor in a university, you know, and that's what the whole thing is focused towards you doing. But a professor in a university is making a lot less money than a plumber or a carpenter or an electrician or somebody. So, and they're generally kind of fixed in place, and they probably hate the job and they hate the people they work for. Where people with trades, it's very rare to meet one who hates it. Like, sometimes being a plumber might be a shitty job because you got shit to deal with. But a lot of people have got proper trade jobs. They enjoy it, and often you can be your own boss. So as a climber, you know, rather than being like a mountain guide, you know, where the mountains become the place where you work, and you probably, when you're not working, you're probably not that interested in going into the mountains. You probably end up going road biking or some stupid thing like that instead. You know, if you've got like a trade, you can make a lot of money quite quickly. And as long as you, I think you need to live like you've got no money, you know, live as cheaply, as frugally as possible to build up your, you know, your savings. And then you make enough money, and then you can just go somewhere where you're not going to spend a lot of money. Like, you could go to like Arapiles for 3 months, you know, and then come back and then just start working again, make more money, and then go off to Canada for 3 months, whatever. You can, I think that's the way to probably do it, is to have a, you know, to build up, you know. And often people are always afraid to kind of turn down work, but I think often people who turn down work end up being valued more highly. Like, if you're really good at what you do, you can just give the impression that you're too busy, that's why you can't do it, but actually you're not busy at all, you're actually off climbing for 3 months, then you're coming back. But what people often, they often fall into this trap where they just want to, like, money becomes, you know, you're like, you have this idea of like, I'm going to do rope access, I'm going to make enough money, and then I'm going to go climbing for 6 months and blah, blah, blah. But you very quickly, human nature, you what is it, a luxury becomes a necessity. You suddenly, your lifestyle changes, you know, you get a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a it friend, and you suddenly, you know, you don't have any money anymore. You're making all this money, but you've got your fancy car and you've got your gym membership and you're learning to skydive or whatever. You know, suddenly you don't have any time. You have all this money, but you have no time. And then you suddenly don't have any time. You don't have any money because you're just spending all your money on stuff. And then suddenly you're in debt, so you can't stop working. And then you have no time. You have less than no money because all the money's... Anyway, so it's very easy to get into that thing. So hopefully, like modern, new generations, you know, of younger people are probably a little bit more savvy. Like not being in debt is probably one of the best things you can do in life. You know, it does make a massive difference. You can maneuver a lot more, you know, like, you know, the idea of like fuck you money. Like you don't actually need any money to say fuck you, but you definitely don't want any debt, because you can live with very little money and for a while with no money. But it's, you can't really live if you've got less than no money, if you have to pay someone the money back that you owe them. So it's what's that got to do with drawing? I have no idea. But anyway, develop skills that are actually useful and practical in a recession or whatever. You know, that's people still need their pipes cleaning. That's not to be about a prostitute, but even prostitution. You know, it's hard to get the work. Who you know? Anyway, so we'll go back to a proper question here. So, hi Andy, I have a question for you about the cold. Now, this question is quite old, so this person's either probably dead now of hypothermia, or it's the summertime. So anyway, it might be useful. Background: I am a skier, and I would like to make I am a skier and would like to be making more backcountry skiing trips, but this year has been struggling. I've been struggling with cold, especially loss of hand function, grip strength, ability to move lower portion of arms functionally. I am 38, physically fit, physically very fit, 5'9" and 70 kilos. Subsequently, I don't feel cold, but figure I must be with this loss of function. It isn't very painful. More, I just can't make my hands and wrists move effectively. Have you had any issues with this? Or maybe how to overcome it? How do you do it? Maybe I just need to get fatter. My concern is that one day I'll be experiencing this critical time and could lead to a bad outcome. I could lead to a bad outcome for one of my skiing mates or myself. Well, I'm afraid you've got cancer. No, you haven't. No, I think 70 kilos, 5'9". It sounds like you're a bit too skinny. You haven't got any belly timber. Like, there's a few things it could be. Like, you could have, like, I don't know if Raynaud's disease would... I think Raynaud's just... Raynaud's disease basically means you've got fingers that look white when you hold them up to selfies. People got Raynaud's disease. They're just the kind of people who just whinge on about everything, like, oh, my hands are cold, and all that kind of stuff. It's a bit like dyslexia for your fingers, I reckon. It's like, oh, my fingers, they've got no blood circulation. It's like, oh, get over yourself. So things that could be, this could be many things. Sometimes I wonder how heavy your rucksack is. Like, what are you carrying? Have you got a rucksack on? I wonder, because sometimes, it definitely happens if you've got a very heavy rucksack. Is it basically, you know, stops like the circulation into your arms, like that? You know, if your rucksack strap's too narrow, in the wrong place, that could. Be in effect. But seeing you're going skiing, you're not going to have a really heavy rucksack on, so that's probably not the thing. Could be, what else could it be? Like, if it's just cold, like when you, if you ever, I don't know if you ever had hypothermia, but if you ever fall in the sea and you start swimming, and it's super, super cold. If it's like the temperature where you've got, you've only got like, you know, you're going to be dead in a short space of time. What you find, it's worth trying, it's worth experimenting with this, where in a place where you're not going to drown, is what you find, what happens first of all, is your finger, you lose dexterity, your fingers don't work anymore, and then your hands don't work. So if you're trying to swim to the shore, you start losing any dexterity in your fingers, which has an impact when you're swimming, because it becomes much harder to swim because your hands are not, you know, pointing into the water anymore. They're kind of going a bit weird. In mountaineering, what that means is you suddenly can't untie a knot, or you can't, you know, switch on your phone to ring 999, or you can't put on like an EPIRB or whatever it is. So loss of dexterity in your hands does sound like it could be related to cold or circulation or something. So that's why if you ever think you're gonna, if you're ever in a situation where you think you're gonna get hypothermic and you're gonna start losing dexterity, you need to get anything that requires dexterity done very, very quickly. So say you're under a waterfall, you're on a pitch and it starts pouring with water, and the next minute you're under a waterfall. Like say you're tied in to the rope and the rope is going up to a carabiner, then maybe you suddenly can't undo the carabiner, and you can't undo the knot. Like the carabiner might suddenly start icing over with the water or something, or your fingers just can't do the carabiner. So then you're like, I'm gonna have to like get my knife out. So you try to get your knife, but now your knife doesn't work because you can't open the knife because your fingers aren't working. So you need a knife where you can somehow hold it in your hand and open it with your teeth or whatever. So like quite a lot of like on El Cap, it's a classic way of people who've died of hypothermia on El Cap, or people die sometimes like sea kayaking and stuff. It is because of things like that. Like they couldn't pull themselves back into a kayak because their hands couldn't hold on to the kayak because their hands were so cold. So it's a good thing to know it's a good thing to be aware of that's going to happen, because then you can deal with it. Before it starts happening, you know, you can get out of that, try and get out of that situation before that happens, or, you know, do something like don't use screw gates, you know, clip into the rope rather than tying into the rope and all these kind of things. So maybe, I wonder if he doesn't feel like it's cold. Maybe your hands may, like, because you're quite, I'd say 70 kilos is skinny, but maybe, yeah, it's kind of skinny. So I would wonder if you need to, you're not wearing enough, your hands aren't warm enough to begin with, and that's affecting everything else. So I would probably advise to get rid of your, stop wearing gloves and just get some mittens instead, and just wear your mittens directly onto your skin. Like, don't wear liner mittens, or, you know, just get rid of all that kind of stuff. Just go for a good, decent pair, ideally of like synthetic mittens. Like fiber pile might be okay, but you want something where you can still bend them effectively. Like some mittens, they can be quite stiff. So you want something where you've got, don't get a huge pair. You can get quite a small pair of mittens, like windproof mittens. You know, you don't need Himalayan down mittens or anything, but just something small, and you'll find that your hands will be a lot warmer to begin with. If you're backcountry skiing, so the problem with backcountry skiing is it's very, you get very, very hot when you're skiing uphill, and then you can get quite cold skiing downhill, or you can be very, very hot skiing up onto a ridge, and you're stripping down into your, pretty much down to your base layer, and then you suddenly break onto this ridge, and then you're battered by the wind, and then you get super, super cold, or one half of your body gets cold, and you just keep on going. So I think it's having like a clothing system that you can dump a lot of heat very quickly, and then you can just sort of cinch it. You can cinch it either way. You can adjust it slowly to correspond with the temperature and the conditions. So that's the problem with piss people like strip down, so they've just got they'll have their base layer on, then they'll have the waterproof bottoms, like their bibs or whatever, and then they'll just have the base layer top on, but they won't have a jacket on, and they'll be like skiing up, but they're still going to be like generating a lot of sweat and getting basically quite sweaty. And then you get to the top and you probably put your jacket on, but you wouldn't put anything else on, and that's going to block the wind. But then you still, there's a lot of sweat in there, and you know, so it's having a good system that allows you to, like that's where like your old school soft shell worked quite well, in that you could, you know, dump a lot of heat. Like Paramore have some quite good clothing still like that, where you've got very good zippers on the side, and you can vent a hell of a lot of, you know, you want to roll your sleeves up and just basically like taper it down slowly, so you maintain your comfort, and comfort is not being hot, comfort is being comfortable. So you're either hot or you're cold, and that's what you're aiming for. But if you get really, you know, if you are really cold, you are, the first thing you're going to notice is your dexterity's going. Like your ski, how do you hold your ski poles? That's another thing. Like if you're holding your ski poles too high, you know, that's another, like how, where's the, like all these things are so basic. I doubt it's the problem, but you know, if people who, you know, if you're holding your ski poles at too high a position, now you really want to keep your hands below your heart. So if you're, you know, if you're doing a lot of very high ski poling, you know, you're holding it very high, that could be a problem. How is the wrist loop set up? Are you using wrist loops? Probably best, a bit like the ice axes, is apart from probably maybe skiing down, it's probably good to get rid of your wrist loops and have poles that have like multiple positions, where, you know, like the Black Crow kind of poles, where you can hold them, you know, quite a long way down, and just keep, you know, just keep trying to move your hands up and down, shaking your hands out, a bit like using leashless tools. You know, the more you keep your hands like gripping onto the pole, the more you're probably gonna get cold. So yeah, it's hard to. Maybe you've sorted this out. Send us an email. You know I'm talking about. I'll email you this podcast. You know I've covered it. But yeah, tell us how you got on. So yeah. So right, another question. So this is another kind of, they've had some interesting questions here. Good morning, good afternoon. Do any of your writings get into how you learn to climb with dyslexia? Any techniques that worked for remembering procedures, knots, etc., or learning more effectively? Visual reminders, maybe. I have a daughter that is 15 that climbs with the mountaineers. I'm looking for practical tips for learning and retaining climbing information and techniques. Things I can suggest to her and her leader that might help. Right now, they know she's dyslexic and they give her more grace, but that's about it. She feels stupid when she blanks or forgets the basic stuff about focusing on more advanced techniques for a while, and it gives them pause as well. Anyway, if any of your writings address this, and you can point me in the right direction, it could be very appreciative. So there's the guy Dick Rutan, who was the first person to fly around the world nonstop. It took him like 9 days. You know, they had like a super lightweight kind of carbon fiber plane and like five tons of fuel. He had like an amazing career in the American Air Force, and then ended up leaving and ended up doing this amazing flight around the world. But he was really dyslexic, and he didn't realize until he was writing his book when he was, you know, like he was, you know, retired, and like he couldn't be a pilot straight away in the Air Force because he just wasn't good enough, academic enough. But he had like amazing levels of like engineer, you know, sort of like three-dimensional problem solving, like engineering. You know, he was kind of off the scale with that, but he just wasn't very good on the writing and the reading and everything else. And what he did when he became a navigator, which is still pretty difficult, I would have thought, having to do all the tables and everything else. So he became a navigator. This is in the days where you would be doing like astral projection, or is that something else? But anyway, you're looking at the stars, how to navigate and everything else. But I think what he did actually, when he actually had to be a pilot, he came in and to the classes when he went through pilot school. He actually could already fly. He's actually an expert pilot. Like, he could fly a plane before he had a driving license. And I think by the age of 17, he could fly with passengers. So he could fly at 16, he could fly with passengers at 17, and by 18, he was a commercial pilot, so he could carry stuff in his plane. And he was also a flying instructor. You know, this was all, he was still a kid, basically. But the Air Force were like, you're not used to us, you could never be a pilot. But yeah, he was already like an amazing pilot, but he just couldn't do the written stuff and everything else. So eventually he's had like a long time as a navigator, they allowed him to go into pilot school. Now, this is a very interesting thing about some dyslexic people, where he was like, although he probably saw himself as a retard and he couldn't do all this kind of stuff, he said that, you know, if I was a pilot, I would be the number one pilot, you know, at the Air Force school, and I would end up flying the F-100, which was like the ultimate jet at the time, which very few pilots got to fly because it was the ultimate jet. So he had very sort of low self-esteem, but very high his actuation. I'm too stupid to go to university, but if I did, I'd get a first. You know, that was kind of my kind of thing. So, which is kind of borne out in the climbing I did. I often felt very unworthy to attempt something, you know, much less able than all the other people who'd ever done it. But at the same time, I obviously thought I could do it because I tried. And sometimes I got to the top as well. So, but what he did is when he actually went to pilots to school at the Air Force, he always sat at the front of the class, and in his briefcase he had a tape recorder, and he tape recorded everything the people were saying to him. He took notes, but basically he was doing it through like the kind of oral audio kind of sort of memorizing it that way. And what happened? He ended up being coming out number one in all the Air Force schools of that year. And because he was number one, he could take the first choice of what billet he would take as a pilot. And when they pulled back the curtain with the chalkboard with all the things you could fly, there was two posts for like F-100s. So he got to fly the F-100. So it came true what he'd said that he would do. So I'll put a link in this podcast to an interview with Dick and Jocko Willink, which is it's just very interesting on that kind of thing about, you know, people with dyslexia and stuff. Like, now dyslexia, again, is a bit like the trans thing I was mentioning before, it's not really a thing, I don't think. I don't really believe in dyslexia as a standalone, you're dyslexic or you're trans or you're dyspraxic or you're autistic or whatever. It's kind of just who you are, really. And the same way as some people find coping mechanisms, like if you feel you're in the wrong body, then you could try and, you know, have a sex change and you think that might sort things out. But the same with if you're dyslexic, like it's, you just got to, there's some real advantages. Like if you're trans there's a real advantage about being an outsider. You know, that can be a massive advantage as long as you don't want to be an insider. And the same with if you're dyslexic, you are kind of a bit of an outsider because things that make sense to everybody else are often don't make sense to you. But you will often see things that other people can't. And some things that other people find really, really difficult, you'll actually find really, 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 really simple. Now, in the case of climbing, like I couldn't tie my shoelaces until I was, you know, like in my teens, basically. I just could not do it. Now, I think one of the issues is that broadly what a dyslexic person is a bit like someone with ADHD or whatever, or I call it like attention focus syndrome, is that you're not really interested in stuff, so you don't bother retaining it, or if you're not interested in it, you're just not interested in it. So I wasn't really interested. I could get by without, you know, I could get like shoes of Velcro or whatever. I could kind of do a higgledy-piggledy knot, but it always came undone, so my shoes are always undone all the time. Like I basically spent a lot of my childhood wearing Wellingtons, basically. But when it becomes important, then you can, like, I'm not someone who can tie 1,000 knots. I have friends who can tie every knot in the world. Like I can only tie a few knots, but I'll tie them pretty well, you know. No, but I'm not good at retaining things that I'm not finding and don't find useful. So I'll get very interested in something, and I'll, like, at the moment I've got a cast iron frying pan. Now I've never had a cast iron frying pan, but I'm trying to become an expert in cast iron frying pans. So I'm like watching lots of YouTube videos. I just like the idea of having a pan that's going to last forever rather than all these, because you get like a frying pan, and my wife likes to get the frying pan so that it's like roasting hot, like it's like going to burst into flames. And then she just puts it in the sink in the cold water. So then it ends up looking like a balloon. It's like, you know, it's like a wok all of a sudden. So any fat you put in it just goes straight to the middle, and that's it. So anyway, so I quite like the idea of having a cast iron frying pan, like a kettlebell that you can like cook on. So anyway, so that's an example of like, suddenly I'm really interested in like different kinds of oils and fats and the temperature of, you know, the sort of the, you know, just loads of stuff, you know, like how, you know, when you season it, like what is this seasoning a pan? What does it actually mean? And how do you do it? And blah, blah, blah. So anyway, but I'm only doing that because I'm interested in it. And a lot of the information will just be forgotten. And so with like the climbing big walls or climbing techniques, you know, like a lot of it, you just kind of forget it. Like a lot of the stuff to do with numbers and forces, I just kind of forget them, really. Like if I'm writing a book, I have to kind of understand them to write a book. But then once the book's finished, I'll probably just forget them. Like I can't tie like a Zeppelin bend, even though it's in one of my books. And I could tie it when I wrote the book and I thought it was a useful knot, but I can't remember how to tie it now. So, you know, so it's, but something like a Monster Munter hitch, I can remember how to tie that because it's one of those knots where I've had to use it in the real world, and it was like incredibly useful. It probably saved my life. So I retained that knot. But other knots, like less so. Like I couldn't tie a bowline for years and years and years because I just couldn't remember how to do it. It always used to come undone. And then for some reason, I started knowing how to do it, and I just retained it. And even now, I might get it wrong a few times. So I think, like it's kind of rare that someone with dyslexia, like again, it's like a very broad term, dyslexia. It could be just you're not very good at remembering anything. If you know what I mean, you know, maybe you're not cut out to be a climber. Maybe you're good at playing the violin or something. You know, like often when you're teaching people to climb, so you're doing like a big wall course, how to climb a big wall, and the person will turn up and you're like, okay, put your harness on, and they can't put their harness on. Like they can't coordinate putting the feet in the right loop and the belay loops, you know, the wrong way around, and the belay loops on the back of their harness or something. And I'm like, I don't think this is probably what you should be doing, you know. So it's like taking someone for a driving test and they get in the back of the car, you know. It's like, I've actually ever been in a car before. So I guess repetition, but even repetition, you know, get a book of tying knots and just focus on the most important ones and get a piece of rope and just keep tying them. Like, and often people will say things like, you know, what's the, like, I could never remember the alphabet, or, you know, like things like nouns and all that kind of stuff. And I never remember any of that kind of stuff. But people would always say, you know, I can't remember any of them already to give you the example, but it's like E after D, except after B or something. It's like, what the hell? Like, you can't give me a stupid thing like that. Like, you know, never put a C in front of a D unless there's a B. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? It has to just, you know, just anyway. So if you think about the, you know, like a bow line, like the rabbit comes out of the hole, around the tree, and back in the hole. Like, it's like, for me, it's like there's like a lake, and the snake comes out, and it goes around the tree and back in the lake. Like, for some reason, I find that easier to remember than the one about the rabbit. Because, like, the thing about the hole is the tree has to be behind the hole. You know, like, the tree could be in front of the hole, but really it's behind the hole. But if it's actually a lake, you know, the tree is behind the lake. I can visualize a lake with the tree behind it, you know, and the rabbit, the snake, is coming out of the lake and around the tree and then slithering back into the lake. That might not work. But anyway, but it's finding ways. Like, I could never remember the word hypocrite. So I always, but I can visualize a hip. So whenever I have to think of the word hypocrite, I would think of a hip or there. As a place, it's got an H in it, and an H is the same as house. House has got an H at the beginning of it. A house is a place, so there with an H is has got an H in it. What's the other there? Is it a where? Yeah, where. Maybe I'm thinking of where. Where has got an H in it as well. Anyway, it's not foolproof, the system I'm using, but it isn't really an excuse to be dyslexic. It's not an excuse, it's not a disability, it's just something you need to, you know. You could be that person who's like laid in a bed and could just wink with one eye, you know, like, just get over yourself, you know. You can work it out, and, you know, if you can't work it out, just tell people you're not very good at it, you know, and people are generally forgiving. Like, if you say you're really good at something and you're crap at it, that's not forgivable. Like, if you say, you know, someone's having a heart attack, you know, and you stand, you know, you know, you say, like, stand back, you know, I know what to do, and you start rubbing their hands together or something, or trying to get water out of the lungs, you know, that's not forgivable. So if you're like, oh, I don't know what to do, you do it, you know. And then sometimes the more you're not good at stuff, the better you are at having methods of dealing with that, and just, you know, living in this like space of like chaos where you just have to improvise all the time. Like, I don't, you know, like the, like, you know, speaking of heart attacks, you know, there's always like the, you know, do it this way, do it that way, like, ha, 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 staying alive, staying alive, you know, doing that kind of rhythm. But then you'll see somebody else and it'd be like, you know, it'd be like some kind of like, some song you've never heard of, like Chumbawamba or something. Anyway, so yeah, but you'll see on someone on Instagram, and it's like, why is it telling me to do it this way? Like, I thought you had to do it the other way, you know. And then what about the breathing? How often am I supposed to breathe in this person's mouth? But you know, when you actually
I was climbing at the climbing wall once, and someone had a heart attack, and they basically were dead. They were also like climbing, which is lucky they weren't belaying. But anyway, but they were lowered down, and by the time they got on the ground, they were dead. And you saw all these people who were trained and knew what to do, but they basically probably didn't know what to do, and loads of things just didn't go how you think they would go in that situation. So sometimes, like things like they had one of the defibrillators, and they kind of, you know, ran there with this defibrillator and they stuck it on, but the patches didn't work. They just fell straight off again. They'd like dried out or something. And you know, just doing, being able to be calm and just think through, you know, often if you're not prepared, maybe you're better in that situation. You can be calmer because you've got nothing left. You've got nothing to lose. You know what I mean? In the court of law, you know, you just did your best. You know, you didn't have any qualifications. So I don't know. It's hard to, I think that, like, it's funny that, like, often your parents, the fact that this parent is concerned enough to contact me to help their daughter is probably a good thing and a bad thing. Like sometimes, like when my son, when they told me he had ADHD or some bollocks like that, I the worst thing is to then be diagnosed with something and go through the rest of your school days being like, oh, I've got ADHD, and excuse every bullshit thing, you know. Like, I'm sure they knew all this stuff existed, like in the past when no one got any labels, but they just kind of like beat it out of you. You know, there was no kind of, you know, you were just thick, basically. And a lot is, it's pretty cruel. It's probably better to go through life thinking you're thick than thinking you're disabled, if you know what I mean. You know, so, you know, I don't know. Did they have any of these things? Like, someone said that I was, you know, I was very dyslexic at school, but they didn't diagnose these things because if they did, they'd have to put some money into it or something. They'd have to give you some special lessons or something. So they just said it was like slow at stuff, slow at reading and everything else. So I think there's probably something to be said for it. So yeah, maybe if your parent is overly concerned about your dyslexia, maybe that could be a negative. Maybe like I definitely spend a lot of time with my son and my daughter, because she's supposed to be dyslexic, trying to make them realise that isn't important information, basically. Like, my daughter can, is supposed to be dyslexic, she has to have special extra time, you know, when she was at school, extra time for exams, and she's supposed to get a free computer and all that kind of bollocks. But she got like a first in maths. See what I mean? She's like a highly successful person. It made no difference to her life being dyslexic. I think for my son, it probably has had an effect on how he visualizes himself. I think that's why you don't want to get divorced, because you can, you know, you got one parent inputting loads of shit into your child, and you got another parent trying to, you know, deprogram them from all this kind of stuff. But once you divorce, you know, you don't really have enough, you know, the programming can stick, really. So, yeah. Right, I think the baby must be awake by now. It must be time to take this baby for a walk, so I better leave it there. So yeah, I'll send this podcast to this lady with her dyslexic daughter, and I'm sure this isn't very positive. This is probably not what you want to hear, but I think you just have to rise above it. I think you just got to, you have to see it as an advantage. Like, even that guy laid in bed who can only wink and has got locked in syndrome, like, you know, he has an advantage. Like, he sees the world in a very unique way, you know. So yeah. So yeah, that's a great bit of wisdom there. Okay. what I'm going to talk about next time, something amazing. I am actually thinking about doing a podcast, a separate podcast with no waffle, and just talking about clothing to tie into this book that I'm eventually going to write. This, what's it called? By a Thread, it's called. So I might do that, because it might be good to break, to get rid of some of the waffle. I know some of you like the waffle, but it'd be quite good to do something a little bit more focused on one thing, which is, see, that this is a classic dyslexic brain of mine. I don't even have time to do this bloody podcast, and I'm talking about doing another one as well. So that's a good example of what I'm talking about. So yeah, anyway, until next time, see you soon.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.